Welcome to SDI Encounters, a podcast from Spiritual Directors International. I'm Matt Whitney. Thank you so much for listening. I offer a heartfelt welcome to new listeners and a welcome back to existing subscribers. If you like this show, please do click on the subscribe button. Here we offer a wide range of perspectives, stories, and conversations centered around community, spiritual companionship, and spiritual care. You'll find additional information, including videos, webinars, and digital publications at our website, sdiworld.org. SDI is a member-supported global contemplative movement that contributes to peace, justice, and living in right relationship with all creation. Your membership supports this podcast, publications, educational programming, outreach, and more. Together, we are changing the world through the contemplative action of spiritual direction. Everyone is welcome to become a member of SDI, and you definitely do not need to be a spiritual director to join. Membership benefits include subscriptions to our Presence, Listen, and Connections publications, our Discover newsletter, discounts on educational events and gatherings, and more. Become a member or renew your membership today on SDI's secure online store, which is secure.sdiworld.org. Danny Forbes is a pastor and spiritual care provider in the Seattle area and was a presenter at our post-conference retreat in Seebeck, Washington. She studied at Seattle Pacific University and Princeton Theological Seminary, where she went on to serve in pastoral roles in Belfast, Northern Ireland, Cape Town, South Africa, Los Angeles, and now in Seattle. In this episode, we went deep into how Danny lives out Christian spirituality in her work as a pastor and a mother. I found her earthy, in-the-moment practice of Christianity to be an earnest embrace of all matter as spirit-filled, and that a deeper presence can occupy all these spaces, including suffering, death, and grief. When I asked her about her favorite spiritual practices, her response surprised me. It was basically to not separate spiritual practice from lived embodied experience. Danny, you just taught a workshop at our retreat about embodied Christian spirituality. Mm-hmm. Can you define that a little bit?
You know, it's so interesting. The first 500 years of our Christian tradition, or my Christian tradition, I should say, were really all about understanding how the humanity of Jesus was a real thing and how it really mattered. And so when you do the readings around that, what you come to understand is that the foundation of this faith that I adhere to and that I practice was really about this idea that God chose to embody humanity fully, every part of it, every single part, the shadow side, the chaotic peace within it, the sort of visceral reactions that we have. That God embodied and took on every single part of who we are. And I feel like that is one of the most generative and important parts of my faith at the moment, because I feel like we tend to be such a disembodied people in a disembodied culture. And this is an aspect of my theology and my faith that helps me to mitigate against that and to find a different narrative.
What does it look like to be disembodied?
Yeah. I think it looks like, you know, losing track of our gut, like having intuitions and not trusting them, mm-hmm. Having feelings and telling ourselves that there's no data to support it, having sort of this sort of sense of when you feel like, sometimes you get this feeling where you kind of feel it. And nobody will say this out loud. People are totally afraid to talk about this. But because I'm a pastor, sometimes they'll tell me all the crazy things that happened in their life. So they'll say things like, I just felt like I was supposed to reach out to this individual. And I called them and I found out that their mom had just gotten into the hospital, you know, and there's no data to like support that one should follow an intuition. There's also a lot of intuitions where we don't discover information like that. But if we don't trust our gut, if we don't trust the impulses of our body, then we never we never start to learn what it feels like when everything comes together and it kind of happens the right way, or something is illuminated that we couldn't have seen unless we followed that. So I guess that was a way of saying what it is like to be embodied. I think when we're not embodied, what we end up doing is limiting our sense of knowing to just the rational self.
Hmm. I talked to Preeta Banerjee mm-hmm. earlier, yeah. who was a presenter and a presenter from the Hindu perspective. Mm-hmm. And she taught this practice, like, ask your body, you know, questions, and mm-hmm. it will tell you the truth. And she had this thing we did where we had our hands out extended, and we would bring them together and ask ourselves a question. Is my name Matt? And then my hands would come together, and then I would hold them up like this to my face. And if they were aligned, then my body is agreeing with me. But then it's like, am I restful at this retreat? And then I hold them up and my hands are crooked. And I was blown away by that. It's, I was like, that is like the most profound thing I've ever seen. Like, whether, like, to like actually listen to our body, it speaks to us.
Yeah, and it has a different way of speaking than the language that we, you know, are using right now, right? I mean, our language has grammar, we can dissect it, we can say what tense we're speaking in, we can look back and see what the history of specific words are, what the etymology is, what the, how we've gotten to where we are. We can write essays, right? We can do a whole bunch of stuff with our language, and our body doesn't speak like that. You know, it speaks differently. It uses impulses. It uses energy. It uses alignment. It uses pain. It uses all these other things. And I think, you know, we've kind of completely disengaged ourselves from that. But then when it speaks to us, like you had encountered today, we are like, wait, what? You have a voice too? It does. It just has a voice that's different. We can't put it through the same tests that our written language goes through. We have to sort of learn to intuit and kind of get a feel for it, you know? But it's definitely there. That doesn't surprise me at all. Yeah.
How are you able to, or do you bring that to spiritual care mm-hmm. when you are working with people, whether mm-hmm. in your church or mm-hmm. wherever?
I'll just, for myself, I feel like I need to bring it with me. Because I feel like that is my most authentic space. And if I am not in touch with that, it is very hard for me to be true and real and present with people when they are deeply, deeply suffering. Mm. Because when somebody is suffering and I'm not suffering, but they are, and let's say, let's push it a little bit further and say that this isn't a person that's close to me. This is a person who I work with, but maybe they're not close to me. Maybe I, for instance, let me put it this way. If your child is suffering, there's a degree to which that suffering is part of your suffering, right? So you can come alongside them and almost enter into that suffering. But if somebody that you don't know is suffering, and yet you are walking alongside them, the temptation is to sort of really pull back in distance, because I don't want to enter into your suffering, right? Yeah. I don't want to have those feelings that you're having. I don't want to share in that, the sort of the depth of what you're experiencing, because it's hard and it's not my story. And I'm going to have to walk out of that space and sort of put myself together. And I can walk away from it. But the work of spiritual care is figuring out how do you deeply enter into the stories that you are walking alongside fully. And the only way that you can do that is to be grounded and within your body fully, and to trust your gut and your intuition, and to be fully present with the folks that you're working with. Otherwise, you run the risk of sort of dousing people with religious authority and religious language, and it feels false, and it feels like a betrayal of our humanity, you know, that somehow I've given you the Lord's Prayer, so we're all good, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. And we can kind of wipe our hands and be set free. But the Lord's Prayer, as meaningful as it is, it's just words unless they're embodied, right? Unless they're somehow held within a space that has meaning and flesh. And
yeah. Let's talk about those words. John 1, right?
Yeah.
Is the, in the beginning was the Word, mm-hmm. and the Word was God, and, mm-hmm. and the Word became flesh and mm-hmm. dwelt among us. And you quoted that. Mm-hmm. You brought that scripture, that sacred text mm-hmm. up as a part of your theology. What? How do you understand the Word, mm-hmm. The meaning of that?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, another thing that came up was just how we sort of fill that space with words.
Yeah.
So when you talk about just, well, I cite the Lord's Prayer just to sort of like cover over this thing, but it's, mm-hmm. it feels sort of out of context mm-hmm. and not really the right thing for that moment.
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever reason, the reasons you said, we don't want to engage with that pain. We don't want to engage with that suffering. So my question is rambling now. What is the Word? I'll start.
Yeah. There. And how is it connected to the body?
Yeah.
What's the relationship between sort of the Word and flesh? And I think what I said was that the text says that the Word became flesh and we keep trying to make the flesh become Word again.
Yes, that's what it was.
Yeah, which is so true. I think I'll try to get at your question through sort of another rambling approach.
Yeah.
So I'm the mother of three children, and I was able to be with my children when they were small and when they were pre-verbal and learning how to speak. And I loved watching that process unfold, and especially as somebody who studied literary theory, it was really fascinating to see the emergence of language happen with three different individual humans. And what I observed, now I'm not a speech therapist or anything, but what I observed happening with my children is that they would sort of have an experience within the world and then kind of like eventually discover that there was a word that captured that experience, right? And that was like a really empowering thing for them to have. Like all of a sudden they could say mom, or they could say, what was another thing? Dog was another word that came up a lot. Or when there were more than one, they could point to the other and say the other one's name. And there was a way of naming these things that happened in their everyday life. But the other observation that I had around that is that if they didn't have those everyday experiences, those words would be meaningless. You know, the words were only important because they reflected or they somehow captured or gave voice to their lived experience. And that really helped me understand why language is so powerful, and also how when it sort of snowballs and gains momentum and everything becomes so word-based that it runs the risk of being disembodied, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then it runs the risk of losing all of its meaning because we don't know what experience it's pointing to. We don't know what feeling it's talking about. We know what the word means, but we don't know what it feels like in our bodies. But when you see the development of language, those two things go hand in hand. In a really sort of symbiotic way, like the child will all of a sudden see the tree and be able to say tree, and they feel like finally I can put a word around this thing that I've been feeling for the last 2 years and I haven't been able to like talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So when words can actually reflect our lived experience, when they can embody what we have sort of touched and smelled and tasted, then I think they are in connection with flesh. But when they start becoming way out there and and begin to lose their touch with what it is that actually makes sense on the ground, that's when all of that stuff starts to happen, where the flesh becomes word again. I mean, what does it really mean? Like, what? Then we start creating all of these policies or creating all of these rules, but what's they really mean? What do they really do? What do they really accomplish? We don't know, because we have to see how it happens on the ground. You know, we have to see that lived experience first.
Yeah. Related to that, you mentioned, you know, going, say, to a hospital, providing spiritual care for somebody who is sick. Mm-hmm. And how sort of disembodied or meaningless it might be to just recite a piece of scripture, piece of the Lord's Prayer, or something else. Mm-hmm. As beautiful as that text may be, it's disembodied in that moment, right? And I know Christians who are afraid of providing spiritual care for people because they think they don't have the right head knowledge.
Yeah.
They don't have the right memorization of scripture. So they can't just like pull verses out of their head and apply them to whatever situation comes along. And I think a lot of Christians think that's what Christianity is.
Yes.
And so you are describing something very different from that. Mm-hmm. How, as a Christian, do you bring that Christian faith to those situations, to those care situations, whether someone's sick or anything, right?
Yeah.
That's not just reciting words.
Right. Well, I think, such a good question. I think I've had the really, really, really fantastic privilege of being able to walk alongside others who I've seen do this very work. So I've had a chance to learn from, just really simple people, but people who are doing this work. I walked alongside and learned from a pastor in Belfast for a year in his spiritual care, where he would visit people on a daily basis, multiple people, and always sort of kind of trying to approach this work. I learned so much from working alongside another pastor in Cape Town, South Africa, who, again, was all about, maybe she wouldn't have used this language, but was really all about the presence alongside other people. So I've had the opportunity to learn from other people, and that has been a great gift to me and has informed my practice. But I feel like, and because of that, I feel like it's been my great challenge and my life's work, or at least part of my life's work, to figure out how do I integrate my Reformed theology into this practice? Because Reformed theology and the history of Reformed theology is all about the Word. It's all about the Word and getting the belief right and getting the creed right and getting the catechism right, and teaching the right thing and preaching the right thing. That is the history of Reformed theology. And so how do I reach into that tradition and find something that's going to ground me in the middle of this hospital visit, right? Where you're faced with somebody who is on the threshold of death or on the threshold of something. You don't know. Are they going to recover? Are they not? They're in a liminal space. Where do you sort of access? Because at that point, it's really not about beliefs. You're not going into that room and saying, I mean, some people practice spiritual care this way. I would not advocate for going into a room and sort of making sure everybody in the room is a Christian and making sure that everybody has accepted Jesus, you know, before the potential passing happens. I would not practice that way. But I know that that has been a practice, and that has been a child of Reformed theology, that way of practice. But instead, to be able to access sort of this deeper side of my tradition, which goes way back, into the early years of the formation of the church, where they were trying to figure out, what is the incarnation even about? You know, who is this person? Who is this Jesus? And it's really in those years, which are connected to, you know, to the tradition that I find myself in. It's really in those years that I've found, okay, this is a home. This is a spiritual rich place that I can live, where I can find the resources that I need to go into that liminal space where people are sort of on the edge of life and death, and say, the incarnation is about God's presence with us, God's choice to be with us in our suffering, God's choice to love us from the foundation of the world and to be with us in every instance that we find ourselves in. There's no part of our darkness that God has chosen to separate himself from, God's self from, that God is in every piece of who we are as human beings, not because I believe in Jesus, but because Jesus has made that choice from the foundation of the world. And that means that I can enter into any space with that knowledge, that this person is deeply loved by God. This person has been chosen in love by God. And that the suffering of Jesus is in existence alongside this person's suffering right now as we speak. And if you even just reflect on the depth of that, that gives you the space to say, I'm not in here alone. I'm not representing God. God is here. I show up and bear witness to that presence. That's it. And that is embodied spirituality, right? Because it's recognizing, I'm not bringing a word that's going to change anything. I am instead practicing the reality that God is already there because of what I know about the person of Jesus. And therefore, I simply show up and my words bear witness to the experience, right? Which is kind of what we were talking about with the kiddos learning language. Their words bear witness to the experience. Mm. And that's when we know that a truth has been spoken, because then when something bears witness to the experience, everybody in the room goes, yeah, you know, and it doesn't always happen, but yeah. It happens often enough for you to go, okay, that was a word that connected. That was a word that bore witness to our actual infleshed experience. The challenge is when the words don't bear witness, and then we're stuck in a different land.
Mm-hmm. There's something that I've been pondering in scripture, and I think it relates, and I'm just going to share it kind of in my own personal spiritual journey. So later in John, at the Last Supper, Jesus is describing basically how he's going to his death. And I think it's in response to Peter saying, like, well, we'll go wherever you go, Jesus. And Jesus is, you know, he says, well, where I'm going, you cannot follow, but you will in a little while. And like, the more that I read and meditate on that, I think he's talking, like, I think Christians, we believe, well, he's going to heaven to become, to presume his throne or whatever. But I feel like he's just describing his going to the cross, and that carries over to when Thomas, I think it's Thomas, who says, like, you know, well, we would go if we knew the way. And Jesus makes his, like, I am the way, the truth, and the life statements. And I think, you know, as Christians, we think, well, that's where he says that Jesus is you know, that I am God. Like, here I am, I'm the way. But more and more, I wonder if he's actually just showing us the way that we all are going to take, that we all are going to follow Jesus in a little while, which is our own deaths. And I think it relates to your understanding of the incarnation and how that encompasses everything about the human body, including suffering and mm-hmm. pain mm-hmm. and even the cessation of that body. Mm-hmm. 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 How does that land with you? Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like a total heretic, but at the same time, it's something that is with me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why do you feel like a heretic?
Well, it's just this very, you know, sort of, it's not, because the church preaches a very triumphant Jesus, right? Mm. A triumphant Christ that defeats death mm-hmm. through the resurrection. I still believe in the resurrection, but I hold that very lightly mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. mysteriously. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I don't think we fully know mm-hmm. what that really means mm-hmm, mm-hmm. or what that looks like. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have the complete picture there.
Yeah, I think, yeah, you're onto so many things. I love actually what you're saying. So trying to just kind of break it apart real quick. Yes, Jesus has this time, I think it's in John 14 or around there, where he's talking to his disciples in this long discourse of the upper room, you know, and he's basically preparing them for his death and doing all sorts of other things in the middle, like praying for them and washing their feet and all this other kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then he does have the line of, where I am going, you will not follow, but in a little bit you will. And I don't think that there's anything around that text that directly links his reference to sort of these great wide gates of eternal life. You know, there's times in John, especially where he's talking about eternal life. So I don't want to minimize that, but he also spends a lot of time talking about his death and about the fact that there's something happening that they're not going to understand. And that eventually they will have to come to terms with, but they're not going to get it immediately. And he does a lot of that work throughout the Gospel of John. And so I think seeing it as this sort of way of helping the disciples understand that in fact God, and this is connecting back with what we've been talking about, the incarnation, that, and one of the great mysteries, I think, of my tradition that I just find to be sort of inexhaustible, is that really what we're saying there and what we understand is that God is choosing death. That's God's choice. There's nothing that God is not forced into death, that God is not sort of victimized into death, but that God, from the very foundation of the world, sees death and says, okay, you know, that's part of the story too, and I will take that into my being. And so God sort of encompasses and digests and holds that space of death, which is one of the reasons why, to put this into practice, why when I walk into a place where there's spiritual care needed, it's the depths of that theology that gives me grace and the space to hold it, because I kind of feel like there's nowhere you can go where there won't be the presence of Christ, at least should we hold these things to be true. And so death is a space where we do not have access into that space until we pass into it. But the verse that you're talking about paves the way for us to understand that that space is not empty. It's occupied by a gracious presence who has chosen to be there from the foundation of the world. And so when we see somebody who is passing into that space, now there's a lot of grief around that, and I'm never going to minimize that, and we never want anybody to go too soon. But I will say, in instances where I work with very elderly people who are actually longing to be passed into that space, there's a sort of beauty around that to say, you know, here you go. You know, you're being sort of held in a space that is not vacant, that is held by this person of Jesus. But then you had a second part of the question that I've now forgotten.
Just, you're talking about the gracious presence.
Yeah.
in that space is really, I think, what I'm getting at. I mean, I think that's how I'm understanding that story in John.
Yeah.
Is just that, like, he is showing us the way, which we all have to take.
Right.
But that space is not void.
Yeah.
It is filled.
Yeah.
And then maybe just really quickly, what are some ways that you sustain yourself? Like, mm-hmm. what are the spiritual practices that you have that enable you to do this work?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm a gardener, so I try to make sure that I'm spending a good amount of time with my hands in the dirt. I grow a flower garden from seed every year, which is really fun. Every year, this is my second year of doing it.
Nice.
But I try to embody things like that. Like, you know, I've done the flower garden for 2 years, but before that I was like making sourdough bread and trying to figure out how to keep this starter alive. And that was, you know, an embodied experience that I felt like was helping me slow down and kind of get my hands in something that's actual sort of raw material. You know, you really have to kind of knead the dough there. So that was one of the spiritual practices that kept me grounded. And then the other piece is that it's really important for me. And this is probably, I didn't see this as a spiritual practice until recently. It's very important for me, and I do my best, although I mess up in this area too. But it's very important to me to be a human with every person that I meet. And I've kind of seen that as my new spiritual practice. And what I mean by that is that pastors, and maybe many people in the religious life, we have this ability to sort of step behind the curtain and be non-humans, you know, like because we're always talking about these really deep things, people tend to think that, like, we don't cry in movies, or like we don't get mad when our kids annoy us in certain places, or that we don't, you know, yell at people in traffic, or I don't know, what are other things that, you know, are just normal human things. And I kind of feel like I'm trying to just be a human in every situation that I'm in. And I know that that's a disappointment to people, but I'm sort of like, well, that's kind of how it is. Like, that I would be doing a disservice if I sort of lived into this ideal that I had it all together, because I don't.
Yeah.
And that to me has become a spiritual practice that's kept me grounded. Because otherwise it's too easy to sort of let yourself float away, you know, and become this, this voice.
Yeah.
That doesn't quite have to do the laundry, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
like, no, I'm the voice that also has to do the laundry. And I, you know, I'm at that point where I've got two almost teenage boys and a husband, and I can't tell their underwear apart, you know, like everybody's underwear looks the same. And that's just where I am. So I'm putting underwear in the wrong baskets and getting, like, everybody at home gives me a hard time about it, but that's, that's also part of my lived experience, you know, that's part of who I am. And I don't really want to be a person who doesn't have those kind of things, you know?
Mm. Yeah. We're not perfect.
Yeah.
And so why do we try to be? Like, why do we wear these personas?
Yeah.
Or why do our faith leaders, you know, feel like they have to be a certain archetype?
Yeah.
Or, you know, have some persona, right?
Yeah.
And it's we've been using the word disembodied,
mm-hmm.
but it's inauthentic, I think. And I think that's, you know, people are longing for that authenticity.
Yeah.
And it's not because, a leader is so, like, great, but because people are real. I think that's what I think people are looking for.
Yeah.
It's just people also doing real life. Who will walk alongside them and affirm their real life.
Yeah. And so I think sometimes I'm good at that and sometimes I'm really not. Like sometimes I totally miss the mark and say the wrong thing. And sometimes I land it and sometimes I'm just a big jerk and I didn't even see it. You know what I mean? So it's like, I think if I can keep all of those pieces, you know, fresh in my mind, then I don't take myself too seriously, because I think I always run the risk of doing that. And thankfully I have good people around me who are trying to help me not take myself too seriously, but it's a constant battle with this kind of work, because you do really serious work and then you also have to like have a conference with your child's teacher or, you know, something else that's totally random. And you've got to find ways to put these things together, you know, to just have it all kind of live in the same box and be okay with it.
Yeah.
Even if some parts are just totally imperfect and gross and uncomfortable and like a part of your personality that you're not proud of and or maybe even ashamed of, you know, that's the other piece of it. Like letting the shame live there too and be like, yeah, that's a side of myself I'm really ashamed of and it's just there, you know. So I'm trying to see that as a spiritual practice.
Yeah.
And just I'm not really winning in that area. I'm just like working on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone's toilets get clogged.
Yeah, everyone's toilets get clogged. Everybody gets mad about that, right?
Yeah.
You know, everybody gets frustrated with their partners and their spouses. And like we're just a big mix of people. I read a really amazing quote last night. I'm reading this book called Kitchen Table Wisdom, which I just keep talking about with everybody that I meet. But there's a part of it. It's Rachel Naomi Remen and... At the end of the chapter that I read last night, she said, because she's talking about judgment and how we're so, like, so often we just look for the good in people and we judge the bad. But she talks about how some people who, like, everybody's a mix, right? Some people who are, like, quote, unquote, really bad people do really good things. And she said that, you know, perhaps if we were able to suspend judgment, many things could be holy. And I was like... Yeah. Mm-hmm. yeah, many things could be holy, you know, if we could provide the space within ourselves to recognize that even that which is imperfect and seemingly potentially offensive, how does holiness enter into that space too? I don't know the answer to that question, but I think there's got to be a possibility.
Doing laundry, sitting with sick people, unclogging toilets, these are probably not the things you think of when you think of spiritual practice. Yet our everyday lives ground us in humility and keep our sense of the divine from becoming too stratified. So here's a spiritual practice that you might try. Take on a dirty job. Do the dishes, take out the garbage, even clean the toilet. But do so with sacred intention and treat it as holy. This is Matt Whitney with Spiritual Directors International. Thanks again for listening. Your time and your presence here are deeply appreciated. If you liked this show and would like us to continue making them, please do subscribe now while it's fresh on your mind. Also, we would love to hear from you, so please feel free to send in your comments and suggestions to the email address podcast@sdiworld.org. To learn more about spiritual companionship and ways that you can plug in and join our community, visit us at our website at www.sdiworld.org. Thank you. Blessings and peace on your day, and may you share blessings and peace to others.